Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
It's time for your favorite show. The Weekend Report is on the radio.
The Weekend Report is on the radio, and we appreciate you joining us. You manhandling that microphone over there?
No, it's just, well, you know, I was moving it, and I'm sure the listeners are like, what the heck is that? So I had that look on my face.
Welcome to the Weekend Report. Thanks for listening to us.
Tony, you know I'm not a broadcast professional like you are. Cut me some slack.
I'm turning my headphones down until you're done hitting that.
I'm done. I promise I'm done. I didn't mean to scare anybody. So welcome to the Weekend Report. It's FM News Talk 97.1. Tony Colombo here with my partner,
yes,
Chris Arps. And the voice that you just heard was Virginia Cruda from the Daily Caller, who's going to be joining us for most of this first hour. Great to see you. Thank you
so much
coming in. Mm-hmm. Brian McKenna, producer of The Stars.
Still here.
As well.
Still here.
Still here.
Yeah.
Hasn't been promoted yet, but that'll be happening anytime now. So, we got a whole lot to talk about. We got a great show coming up today, too. Skip Weber is finally back.
Yeah.
He has been on a long hiatus, traveling the globe.
Yeah.
He's a busy man, but he is back. So, that'll be in the second hour. We will have another edition of the Weird News Challenge. I keep getting weirder and weirder with these things. This one is unlike anyone we've done before.
Will I have a chance?
Yes, you will.
Okay.
Everybody will have a chance. But it's I've gotten even more creative with the category.
Okay.
That's all I'm going to say for now. So Skip will be here in the second hour, and we'll play the Weird News Challenge. Like I said, Virginia is here for the bulk of this first hour. Before we get started, tell people, Virginia, how they can follow you on social media and read your stuff on the Daily Caller, because it's stuff that I highly recommend.
Okay. To read my stories and stories of many of my gifted colleagues, you can go to thedailycaller.com, and you can find me on Twitter at VA Cruda.
How did you get hooked up with the Daily Caller? Like, how did you find that publication, get involved with it, and why do you feel like it's a good place to work?
Well, I had been reading them for a long time. If you don't know the history, the website was started by Fox News host Tucker Carlson, mm-hmm, and a college buddy, Neil Patel, who about 9 years ago now, I think 2010 is when they went live. And Carlson is no longer at the website because he's at Fox, but Neil is still running the ship and doing a great job. And when I left the Independent Journal Review, which was February of 2018, I had some friends who were working at the Daily Caller at the time, and they apparently broke down some doors and told them to hire me ASAP. So I had help. I had help. And I had worked with those guys before, and they vouched for me, and I went freelance for a little while, and then they picked me up full time, and so I've been there for a little over a year, and it's a good fit for me. It's a handful of Marine veterans running a newsroom, and
that's great.
That's
I love that.
Nothing politically correct ever gets said by anyone. Yeah, and it's I've been in the newsroom a couple of times. It's actually in D.C., and so I've been there watching a Trump press conference, and it's literally a bunch of people at desks who can kind of see the TV yelling at it throughout the whole thing. So it's kind of like watching a press conference from my house.
Yeah, right.
Because that's how I watch them. So,
and you know, Tony, the insiders call it the D.C. Just want to throw that.
Oh,
so you're an insider then?
No, I just heard that.
Oh, okay.
Is that right? Is he making that up?
It depends.
Is that what
on
the posers call it?
There are a couple nicknames. Sometimes we just get the caller. Sometimes we get the DC.
Gotcha.
But you know, we answer to all of them.
Well, it was always in my, you know, like in my rotation of websites to check out. But since we have gotten to know you and you've been on this show so many times, it's one of my like primary go-to spots.
That and
it's
great information. If you want up-to-date information on the Russia investigation and everything, Chuck Ross has done an excellent job doing just breaking down everything. He's had it from day one.
Have a question. I know they say it's the Daler Caller Foundation. The is it a nonprofit or how does that work?
We have two sides. Okay. We have a news foundation, which the Daily Caller News Foundation, that takes on a lot of interns. They train younger journalists, and then a lot of them graduate, go to CNN, go to Fox News, go to produce. With other networks, and generally the writer, they don't have a lot of staff writers that stay for a long time at the News Foundation because the goal is to train younger journalists.
Got it. Yeah, I thought it was
there's two sides. There's the not-for-profit side, and that's the DCNF, and then you see the Daily Caller, which is the for-profit side. And
While I was trying to do serious journalism, Tony was laughing at me. What did I do?
I think you said what did he say?
It was like the Dunkel Caller.
I was going to say whatever.
I'm trying to do serious journalism here. And...
The Dairy Caller. That's a whole different thing.
You have to also speak English.
Yes. That is a requirement.
Well, definitely check it out if you don't already do so. DailyCaller.com. Wealth of information if you're trying to keep up with everything that is happening in this crazy world. Let's jump into this week's stories. There's so many to get to. We are going to start with the Democrats seem to be at an all-time high for calling for the impeachment of Donald Trump. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said this week that it's time to move forward with impeaching President Trump. She said if they don't do it now, it could be viewed as a politically motivated decision. It's a politically motivated decision if they do move forward. Fox News reported this week that a senior House Democrat, speaking on the condition of anonymity, said that Nancy Pelosi could be soon left with no choice but to embrace calls from those within her party to impeach Trump. This official said that the issue is, quote, coming to a head, and that the speaker could be forced to move forward within the next 2 weeks. And I saw this story 4 or 5 days ago, so almost a week has gone by since then. So if this senior House Democrat that was speaking to Fox News is right, then we could be a week or so away from seeing the speaker actually move forward with articles of impeachment. Virginia, is that the best thing that could happen to the president?
I would say so. I don't know if you guys remember. Do you know the story of Brer Rabbit?
Yes.
And, when they're chasing him down, and he says, you know, beat me, hit me, do whatever you want to me, but please don't throw me in the briar patch. Mm-hmm. I feel like, and of course, you know, obviously, you know, the punchline is that Brer Rabbit lived in the briar patch, and so he was doing a little reverse psychology on these guys, and I think that Republicans that are pushing buttons, including the president, I think are kind of doing a little bit of that, because they know that, one, impeachment is not going to be effective. The only thing that House Democrats can do by impeaching the president is basically say, we believe the president's been naughty, and now we all agree on it. That's all that's going to come of this, because it won't get through the Senate.
Right.
There's no way it'll get through the Senate. And they have no power to do anything other than... And they can do that just as effectively by going on CNN, MSNBC and saying, well, we think this is an impeachable offense. That's going to have the same effect as actually impeaching him in the House.
So knowing that they can never actually get him impeached, but they could pass it in the House and make some noise. Do you think that they will go forward with it eventually, or do you think that they're just going to keep yelling about it?
It's going to depend on how many of the younger, louder, more social media literate in the party continue to push it, like Ocasio-Cortez.
Yeah.
If you see more of that from her, I think, and from others in her freshman class, they're putting pressure on Nancy Pelosi. And I don't think she wants to go through it, because she was there when the Republicans did it to Clinton. She knows exactly what's going to happen to her party. But I think she's also terrified of going into 2020 with a divided party or even a party that looks divided.
Right.
So she almost has to jump on this bandwagon. Otherwise, she's jumping on a grenade.
Yeah, that's a good point. Chris, what percentage of the Democrat Party do you think is pro-impeachment, and what percentage is like, look, guys, this is not a good idea?
Are you talking about the Democratic Party or their activists?
I'm talking about the Democratic Party, the actual politicians within the party.
I think the Democratic establishment and the Democratic leadership within Congress don't want to touch impeachment.
What percentage is the establishment?
I think
75% of Democrats want the president to be brought up on impeachment.
I think I agree with that, but I think
and I'm talking about the politicians.
Yeah, but I think I think you're right about that. But I think actually going through with it and doing it is something that they don't want to do.
Right.
I mean, Nancy Pelosi understands that if she goes ahead and doesn't impeach President Trump, and this goes to the Senate, like Virginia says, it's going to fail. It's going to look like you guys did an impeachment process during an election year. This was all politics. And then President Trump is going to be able to say, hey, I was exonerated by the Senate. This was a witch hunt. This was a big joke. You know, Nancy Pelosi is under a lot of pressure, but still the Democratic establishment, the money people and the leadership don't want this. And I think they'll let them make a lot of noise, but I don't think she'll give in to this at all.
Virginia, to your point of not wanting a divided party, isn't she being Nancy Pelosi going to be damaged by this no matter what she does? Because she's either going to not go along with what I think is the majority of the party that wants to move forward with impeachment, or she's not going to move forward and piss all those people off, or she is going to move forward, and that's going to be like the worst political move that the party could make. So either way, she's in trouble somewhere.
I would agree with that. I think she's in trouble either way, and I think the party's divided no matter what she does. I think she's trying to avoid the appearance of division. And I don't know how long she can do it. But as far as her being in trouble, I think she's already in trouble in that she's created a situation for herself where the president won't work with her. And she needs him to work with her if she wants to get anything done, because she cannot get anything past the Senate. And if he says no, the Senate's not going to do it in spite of him, unless it's, when you're talking about like a clean aid package, if she wants it and the president's like, yeah, whatever, the Senate might pass it. And then whether or not it gets past the president, that's another thing.
Right.
But if the president is opposed to it, the Senate's not even going to take it up.
Right.
McConnell's made that clear.
And Tony, this goes back to what I told you a few weeks ago when you were kind of upset that President Trump and the Democrats had come together apparently for a $1 trillion infrastructure deal. That's what I was saying. That's just politics.
I don't remember being upset about that.
Not upset, but you were like wondering how they're going to spend our money that we don't have. For infrastructure, and I was telling you, Tony, there is no way the Democrats are going to give Donald Trump a major victory like this during a presidential year. And I think it's the same thing when they came in there and met with him, but she said all this stuff about he's a criminal and all this. She knew that if she said something like that, Trump was going to go off and end the meeting or do something quickly. And that's what they want. They want to be able to say, we want to do infrastructure. We are for this. But the president doesn't want to do it. We can't work with him.
Yeah.
And they knew they had no intentions of giving him a campaign or giving him a legislative victory like this.
I don't know that she thought he would walk out of the meeting. I think she thought she could get away with saying that before the meeting.
I don't know. I mean, look what happened the last time they had a meeting in the Oval Office when he was going off on them and embarrassing them in front of the cameras.
Nice if he'd brought a camera into this one. That would have been entertaining.
Yeah, this was all politics.
What do they expect? I mean, when he walked out of that meeting this week, wouldn't you walk out of that meeting this week?
That was kind of my take on it, too. Like, if you tell, you basically stand outside and tell America that this guy's a criminal and then go in. Like, expecting him to want to work with you. What kind of kind of logic is that?
But that's what they want. They want him. They want to antagonize him and walk out or do something so they can throw up their hand and say, "Hey, we tried to work with him, but look at this guy. He's recalcitrant. He doesn't want to work with
so
us."
So, do you think he took the bait and looked bad, or do you think that by doing that he looked actually like he has a backbone?
Yeah, I'm glad he did, for the reasons that you said.
How is it interpreted by the country?
Well, I think it depends on think it depends on just which side of the aisle you are.
Yeah, because if you're were already predisposed to believe that Trump doesn't want to give the Democrats anything, you're going to believe exactly what Pelosi said about the meeting. But if you're watching it with your eyes open and saying, "Hey, you know, if I were in that situation, or if you happen to be a Republican," to me, it's the same thing that when they made those horrible accusations against Kavanaugh, and he went off in the hearing. And they're like, "See, he doesn't have judicial temperament."
And everybody else was,
If you're falsely accused of something that you know you didn't do, you should be angry. You should respond
exactly
in that way. That's called righteous indignation, and I think that's what happened in the Oval Office this week.
I think that actually, though, usually I would completely agree with you in that if it's one side, you know, if you're already a Trump person, then you're gonna that behavior is just like, you know, reinforces why you like this guy. And if you hate him, then this just reinforces why you hate him, because he doesn't appear to be working together. But I think that we're getting to a point now where some of those, especially like the situation of him walking out of that meeting, could be getting to the point where it could start changing some people's minds. And that's something that's very hard to do. But I think some people can, if they're paying attention, and the Republicans in the White House can get the message out, like, look, like Virginia just said, they were standing outside the meeting talking about what a terrible president, a criminal the president is, that he's unfit for office, he's unfit to lead the nation. Nancy Pelosi this week, I don't know if it was before or after he walked out, but she in public called on the Trump family
to stage an intervention,
an intervention to stop the president from his destructive behavior. Now let's go sit down and, like, I think even people that are a little
leaning. She's going to lose some Democrats, too, that are like, well, if he's that bad, why are you even taking this meeting?
Yeah.
I just want to say before we wrap up here, I think the demise of Nancy Pelosi as Speaker is very premature. Look, she's got the grandmotherly kind of slow kind of demeanor in public, but Nancy Pelosi is a very shrewd operator behind the scenes.
And
the
Speaker, I don't think anybody doubts that.
And the Speaker of the House is a very powerful position where she can put you on committee assignments, she can cut off your money for re-election. So these people that are thinking that they're putting out rumors that Nancy Pelosi is on her way out and the progressives and all that are forcing her hand, I don't believe that for a minute. She is very shrewd.
I would not use the word grandmotherly. Unless you have a really mean grandma. All right, we're going to take a break, but Virginia Kruder from The Daily Caller is going to stick around and join us for another segment, so don't go anywhere. It is the Weekend Report on FM News Talk 97.1. Welcome back to the Weekend Report. It's FM News Talk 97.1.
That Perry can play, man. I love that. That's probably my favorite
Perry
song
Woods,
on
baby.
This album.
You like that slow jam?
You can hear his guitar skills very well on this song.
We got to go out and see him live one day. And you still have not done that, have you?
No, because you keep telling me he's black, and I don't believe you.
Were you here when he was here? Weren't you here when he was here?
I've never met him.
Oh, that's
the
unbelievable.
The elusive Perry Woods.
Welcome back. That's Chris Arps. I'm Tony Colombo. Virginia Kruder from The Daily Caller is also in studio with us for another segment. We started to have this conversation off the air. I want to have it on the air. Ben Carson made some news this week when he announced that he wants to ban illegal immigrants from public housing, which, to me, sounds like common sense.
Right.
But he got massive backlash from the left, saying that he is a despicable human being and that he's he's gonna put a bunch of people on the streets.
Maybe they'll go home.
I just thought that public housing wasn't, that we're paying for, wasn't something that somebody who's not supposed to be here was getting anyway.
So, right. That was kind of, and when you look at the number of people who they said were going to be affected by this, it's a huge number.
Yeah.
What do you remember the figure? I don't remember exactly.
6 million, did you say?
Something like that. Yeah.
There were a lot of, and you're like, well, wait a minute. I thought they weren't getting public assistance. I thought that part of the argument that we needed to allow the illegal immigrant traffic to continue coming into this country was that they were just supporting their families and they weren't getting federal benefits.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, this kind of flies in the face of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what's happening, the federal government is not giving illegal immigrants housing vouchers or allowing them into public housing. What's happening is these illegal immigrants are staying with legal immigrants in public housing, and the government, I guess they do know that they're there, but we are indirectly.
How do they identify that?
What do you mean?
How do they know if somebody's living there legally and they just invite others in that shouldn't be there? Yeah. How does the government know they're there?
How
does Ben Carson know that this is happening?
I think people, I think it goes back to a lot of what the immigration problem in general. We know what's going on, but we just won't follow and enforce the law. You know, Project 21, an organization I belong to, put out a press release on Friday talking about, what was it? Now I can't remember what the heck it was.
Was it about illegal immigrants living in public housing?
No. Wow, I just had a complete brain fart.
Well, here, let me ask you this.
Come to me.
Yeah, let me ask you this. The Democratic Party, the liberals are supposed to be the party of the minorities. They are supposed to be the ones that are sticking up for blacks and Latinos and, you know, how can, if they are truly the party of the poor and the ones that are going to, you know, give all these entitlements to these groups, how do those groups stay with the Democrats when, if they, because there are plenty of people in, there are plenty of American citizens that are homeless or need help and could use public housing, but we're giving it to illegal immigrants. How do the Democrats square that with we're the party of the minorities? And how do they keep getting away with it?
I don't know about that. When you've conditioned people to believe that, and it all comes back to, what is it, the soft bigotry of lowered expectations, where they tell minority groups that you can't get there but for our benevolent help.
Yeah.
And if you've bought into that long enough, you're going to keep believing that the government's there to help, even if you don't actually get
there.
Even if
you're not the one getting, they're handing the help to somebody else, and they're passing on the American citizens that are here and could use that help better.
Tony, I got my brain back.
Go ahead.
What we put out a we put out a press release, and Donald Trump's been getting a lot of flack on this, that he is enforcing a 23-year-old law that the Clinton administration initiated, that if you sponsor a legal immigrant or a immigrant family and they end up on welfare or using social safety net benefits, then that person that sponsors them is responsible to pay back that money to the government for the benefits that they're using. So he's getting a whole lot of flack about that, and it's like, why shouldn't you? If you sponsor a family and they start using Medicare or all that type of stuff, why shouldn't you be responsible for paying back that money to the taxpayer?
Seems like common sense.
Yeah,
but everybody's called despicable for doing so.
Yeah. Oh, see, my favorite part of the hearing, and this was actually kind of funny, because everybody's kind of poked fun at Ben Carson now and then about his kind of the slow way that he speaks, and he seems sleepy. And Ilhan Omar made a comment about it because he made a mistake in the hearing, and he said something about wanting to reclaim his time, and they're like, but the time isn't yours. It belongs to the woman questioning you, which, you know, his error. He doesn't do a lot of these hearings. It's not like he was not a congressman or senator before. And so you could understand he wouldn't know this and, you know, move on.
Mm-hmm.
But Omar says, not sure he was fully awake. Maybe he meant to reclaim his time back to sleep. He responded to her, since you brought it up, I know what it's like to actually be sleepy, especially after 18-hour surgeries and operating on babies in the womb. Mm. I hope Omar knows I care about all people, even those she doesn't recognize as having a right to life.
Booyah!
Love it.
That was a classy.
He wasn't mean, but man, did he stick it to her.
Yeah.
In high school, we would have said, you got your coat checked.
He got bowled over in the 2016 election because, you know, he's not aggressive and he was up against the likes of Trump and, you know, many others that were. But his line in that one debate is still one of my favorite lines of any debate ever when he said, "Will somebody please attack me so I can talk?" Because they're attacking Trump and they're attacking each other. You know, he's Little Marco and Lion Ted and, you know, and all these attacks, and everybody gets to if you get attacked, you're allowed to respond. And Ben Carson's just standing there at his podium. He's like, "Will somebody please attack me so I can talk?"
And you forgot,
I thought the line was brilliant.
And you forgot to say, too, that he wasn't a very good candidate, too.
There's that, too.
But, I mean, you know, he was standing. I remember, like, when they would, after the debates, they would release, like, the minutes that everybody spoke. And he would be, like, way at the bottom because he never got a chance to talk because he never, you know, nobody ever went after him.
Got to jump in there.
Yeah, hilarious. Tensions in Iran. They are going up. This week we saw the president tweet, if Iran wants a fight, that will be the official end of Iran. Never threaten the United States again. How do you feel about the direction that we're going?
I think we're going in a good direction. It's been known for years that the Iranians want to be the main player in the Middle East. During the Iran-Iraq war, they were the ones that were planting these roadside bombs that were blowing up our soldiers and that were maiming them. They're the ones, you know, the Iranians are historically Persians. And at one time, the Persians were dominant, you know, worldwide and control the world. And I think this is basically the Persians wanting to reestablish their empire, and they see the United States as a threat to that, and so they are willing to do these antagonistic things. You know, the Persians are not Arabs. You know, people think because they're Muslims and they kind of look similar that they're Arabs. The Persians are not Arabs, and the Saudi Arabia is one of their biggest enemies. And Saudi Arabia has always said that if Iran gets a nuclear weapon, we're going to get a nuclear weapon to protect ourselves. Mm-hmm. So I applaud the president for doing what he's doing. They are the main one that is one of the main actors that is keeping peace from coming to the Middle East.
Virginia, is the president handling the situation in Iran properly? Is he being too aggressive? Is he not being aggressive enough? What are your thoughts?
Well, I would say that, especially with the movement of troops in that area, you know, they moved in the USS Abraham Lincoln, I think, and one other, and a couple of battle groups. And I think the thing about that is that people are talking about it like it's a big thing, like it's a big deal to be moving them there. And we have traditionally had groups that rotate in and out of that area on a regular basis. So it's not, and it came out afterward that it was actually a routine deployment that they were sending. They just made an announcement about it because it was relevant at the time. So I think that it's, at the moment, he's posturing, but it's a good thing because if you're standing up and being vocal about, hey, we're going to put this here, it's like, you know, being a parent and telling your kid, you know, you don't leave the backyard. By the way, I can see you from the window.
Right.
But this is right out of Ronald Reagan's playbook, though. Mm-hmm. This is peace through strength.
Exactly. Yeah. You make a show of strength in front of them so that you don't have to do it to them.
And a big part of this, too, is, you know, 60% of the world's oil goes through the Strait of Hormuz. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And President Trump has a great economy going on right now. And the last thing is you need oil prices spiking up to $150, $200 a barrel to screw up this economy. So, yes, part of this is security and trying to keep the region safe and our interests safe, but it's also to keep the economic prosperity going so that there's no trouble in that region of the world to mess with the economic recovery.
Politically, the American citizenship, are we weary of, do people see this and go, oh, we don't want to get into another conflict. This is not something like, how dangerous is it for the president to look like he's, you know, trying to take us into some kind of conflict?
It's a fine line.
Yeah,
and it really depends on how people see it, because and I've had issues with the way that that things have gone in as far as strategy and whatnot, because the main issue that we had with Afghanistan, with Iraq, you know, we go in and we don't have a clearly outlined strategy. We don't have clearly outlined goals, and we end up in a situation where rules of engagement prevent us from actually doing anything once we get there. So it's like, okay, we're going to send people over here. We're not really sure how long they're going to stay or what they're going to do, but we're going to send them because it looks like the thing to do at the time. So we need to get away from that. So there are going to be people, and especially with the 24-hour news cycle and the fact that especially military families have family members who have gone through 3, 4, 5 deployments in mm-hmm. the same war, mm-hmm. you know, that becomes kind of a thing that it just makes everybody tired.
Yes.
They don't want to get into another 18-year conflict. Yep.
And the thing is, like any president, when he's going to send troops and our boys and women into mm-hmm. harm's way, he's got to make the case. And if Iran is stirring up trouble mm-hmm. and is a threat to the United States and our allies, then he has to make the case.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Virginia, is there an update here?
I didn't know if you knew about okay, so Phelim McAleer, he's a filmmaker, documentary filmmaker who works with Anne McElhinney. They did a fracking film a few years ago, and they did the Gosnell movie recently. Mm-hmm. He is directing a stage production, which is basically a live reading of the Strzok Page texts. and he has enlisted Dean Cain and Christy Swanson to play the parts of the, and it's called FBI Lovebirds Undercovers.
Oh my God.
Anyway, they're doing this live thing in DC in June, and I wrote about it yesterday. I talked to Christy Swanson about it, and she said, I'm just looking forward to play Lisa Page as written by Lisa Page. And it was great.
God.
So they're going to do it.
The actual text transcripts mm-hmm. is the script of the stage production.
The script is being pulled directly from the text messages that were uncovered and from the closed door testimony given by the two.
That's brilliant.
Yes.
That's awesome.
And they've invited the president to go. They're going to be filming it before a live audience. It's going to be fun.
Oh, my God. That is brilliant. I'm going to definitely keep my eyes open for that. All right. Well, that is going to wrap up this segment. Virginia Kruta, thank you again for coming in and joining us.
Thank you, Virginia.
One more time.
And the treats. Tony, don't forget the treats.
Yes.
The treats.
Oh, my gosh.
I always break my diet. It always breaks because I can't help it. It's so good. So, yeah, before you go, promote the bakery, too, where people can read your articles, where people can follow you on social media, and where people can get those treats that Chris likes so much.
Hey, at VA Kruta on Twitter, dailycaller.com for articles and more, and Kruta's Bakery in Collinsville, Illinois.
Man.
So, where all the good
stuff.
Good.
Yes. Virginia, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We will have you back on really soon. Appreciate
Absolutely.
Every time you come in. All right, we got to take a break. We'll be back soon with more Weekend Report. Don't go anywhere. It's FM News Talk 97.1. Hit it. Here we go. Mm-hmm.
Did you see me jump up?
I did.
Yeah. Look like a rock star?
You're adding something new every week.
Yes. Hurt my ankle.
Yep.
Came
Welcome
down
back to the Weekend Report. It's FM News Talk 97.1. Another big thank you to Virginia Kruta from the Daily Caller, who has been with us most of this first hour. If you want to hear any of that again, go back and download the podcast. I want to get back into some of the topics of the week. I want to get your thoughts on this one, my friend. Missouri passed a law that says only minors, 18 and under, have to wear helmets on motorcycles from now on. Adults no longer have to. Similar situation to the laws in Illinois. What are your thoughts?
Tony, I've always been not confused. I don't know, conflicted. There, that's why. I mean, I'm with you. I kind of take the libertarian view that if you want to do something stupid, the government should not step in your way and let you do it. But then I do kind of see the other side of the argument is that it's a public interest to try to keep people safe so we can keep our insurance rates low and not drive up healthcare costs. So I'm conflicted on it. I really am.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't ride a motorcycle, so I really don't care.
I put it in the same category as I do seatbelts. I think that if you want to, I think that you should wear your seatbelt, and I think you should wear a helmet. But if you don't want to, and you want to risk your life for a silly reason, as long as you're not hurting anybody else, I'm.
Do you think that's a valid argument? Say if there weren't any motorcycle helmet laws in any of the states, and then dramatically you had a bunch of head injuries and deaths, and your insurance company says because of this, we're just going to have to raise the rates on motorcycle riders now because there are no helmet laws and we're having a bunch of accidents and it's driving up our costs. Can you see the potential of
in that hypothetical?
Yeah.
Well, here's my thing.
Because that's their argument.
Instead
in
of going, but that's not an accurate representation of what is reflected in the country right now. Well, you just set up a hypothetical. here's a real thing. I get it. I get that it could be driving up some healthcare costs. I also think that the seatbelt and helmets, the accidents that are caused by people, are probably pretty far down the list of things that are messing up our healthcare system. So let's work on the bigger issues. And if we can work on the bigger issues that are causing, you know, insurance problems and healthcare problems in this country, and we can straighten some of that stuff out, and then we can kind of get down to issues like seatbelts and helmets. I don't think it's driving
trauma cause. Trauma cases are very expensive.
Yeah, I know, but I don't think it's driving the issues that we have with healthcare in this country.
What if we could come up with some statistics that showed how many people died a year that didn't wear seatbelts?
Well, I'm sure it's more, but again, it's still personal choice.
But you don't think that you don't
think it's still personal choice.
You don't believe that
I don't want. I want you to wear your seatbelt. I don't want you to not wear your seatbelt, and I don't want you to not wear a helmet.
But you don't.
But I'm not going to climb in the car with you and have the federal government in the vehicle with you, telling you what you can and can't do, as long as you're not hurting others.
You don't think there are enough non seatbelt wearing accidents that it could affect. Currently, the ones all that
well,
we have to currently affect
that,
healthcare.
Hopefully,
costs.
That makes people put their seatbelts on.
The people are
just
stupid.
Like there are lots of just like there are lots of people that are affected negatively by things like alcohol.
Right,
but alcohol is legal. That I would hope that if you have an alcohol problem, that you get it taken care of.
Right.
But I don't want the federal government coming in and saying. Well, you know, there was more more people in Alcoholics Anonymous than ever last year. Let's ban alcohol.
Let me ask you this. So does the government have any responsibility to mandate things to keep people safe?
On an overall arcing level, yes.
Okay.
At some higher level,
so where's the cross line between?
I don't know. Give me an example, and I'll let you know.
This encroaches on my personal space, but this is like, yeah, the government
you
needs
give me
to
an,
mandate.
You give me an example, and I'll let you know.
Okay, I have something I want to toss out to you guys.
Yeah, go ahead.
So there was actually a day that someone called into the Annie Show, and she was a paramedic, and she talked about how if someone doesn't have their seatbelt on and they're in a car with others who do, a lot of times their body is flying around and injuring other people.
Yeah.
Should there be a law where if you're a parent and you have children in the car that you should have your seatbelt on because you're then risking your children's life by you not having your seatbelt on?
Your kids should have. I have no problem with like car seat laws because kids don't.
But what
can't
about
make
the
up their own minds?
But what about the parents? Should they have their seatbelt on if they have children in the car?
No, I mean yes, they should, but it shouldn't be. It shouldn't be the federal government's job to tell them that they have to do that. Personal freedom, people. I don't know what your problem is with it.
It's a fine line, though. Seriously, between
sure,
personal freedom.
I agree.
Freedom
That's why
and,
I brought it up because it's a good discussion.
You just hope people would be smart about it.
What part of your stupid decisions affect the overall? People's financial health and everything should it
so
mandate
here,
where the
why,
government
okay,
gets involved?
If the government could tell you to put on your seatbelts because they save lives mm-hmm. and drive down insurance costs. Why don't they make a law that says that no car can go faster than 60 miles an hour?
Right.
So that way nobody can speed or anything. Now we have to put governors on our, like, how is that any different than saying you have to wear your seatbelt or a helmet? Hmm. It's not.
See, I agree with you. I just hate that there's people who don't wear their seatbelt.
I agree.
You know what I mean?
Agree.
I
agree, but I don't want the government right. coming in and making all the decisions for us.
I agree.
So
I'm up in the air, Ryan. And I'm not really one hard way, one way or the right. other, to be honest with you. I can see both sides.
Before we run out of time, I want to tie two stories into one here. We saw the John Smith, the billionaire, pay for the Morehouse College class of 2019 student debt. But Elizabeth Warren says that if she becomes president, she will eliminate the $640 billion of federal and private student loans. Hashtag cancel my debt was trending nationally on Twitter this week. If Elizabeth Warren is elected president, then billionaires don't have to pay for student loans anymore, and it's problem solved.
Yeah, and you know, the question here that never gets addressed, the really bigger question, is why is college so expensive? Why do college costs are like 10 times the rate of inflation? Why are college professors making $250,000 a year or plus? Because, and all of these people run colleges. Most of them are liberals. And a lot of these colleges have billion-dollar endowments. So that's where the question really needs to be focused, is why are educational costs so expensive, and why do they rise so much faster than inflation? That's where the real racket is.
Because they get away with it.
Yeah.
That's why.
Because they're liberals.
Yeah, because they get away with it. And now we have... I almost said Nancy Pelosi, Elizabeth Warren.
Same person, right?
Saying she's going to, that's the number one thing that she's going to do when she becomes president is forgive the $640 billion of national debt.
Can you imagine that, though, Tony? You're at graduation. You're happy. Everything's going good. But in the very inner recesses of your mind, you're like, God, I've got $100,000 to pay back. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, after the commencement speaker
stalked. That's why I flunked out of college.
And he's like.
Twice.
Hey,
really? Twice.
And he's like, hey, I'm going to pay for your college education. Can you imagine?
Yeah, it's pretty sweet.
Imagine that?
It's pretty sweet.
That I don't have to go into life with $100,000 of debt.
Right there. That's the way to do it. If a guy wants
find
to come
a rich
along
guy
that,
to pay for your
yeah,
college,
that's. But I'm saying that's. I have no problem with him doing that.
No, I don't either.
But I don't think it's not the government's responsibility to come in and pay off your student debt. If you're lucky enough that you have somebody that did it for you, or the recipient of a gift like that, then good for you.
And
I'm not going to hold that against
you. And I believe you really do devalue the college education if it's just given to you. You know, my parents didn't come from the best economic background, but they put themselves through college because they worked. They did work study. They did what they needed to do. And I hate that that's gone in society now.
Less than a minute to go. Have one question for Brian before we leave this first hour. Have you ever had New Coke?
Careful.
Wait a minute.
New Coke.
New Coke.
Do you remember New Coke? Do you remember New Coke? You're probably too young
Coke. Is it different than the Coke we have now?
Yes.
Oh.
What we have now is Coca-Cola Classic.
Oh, you know what? I think that I do know about that.
They're bringing it back.
Are they bringing it back?
They're bringing back New Coke, one of the biggest business flops in the history of American business.
Yeah, really?
And New Coke is coming back.
Do you
remember New
Coke? I remember New Coke.
Did you like it?
I did not like it. It tasted like Pepsi to me, and
see,
Pepsi
like
tastes
Pepsi
like
better.
Stale Coke.
No, Pepsi's
flat
better.
Coke.
Pepsi
how do you,
better than Coke.
How do you tell the difference between Coke and Pepsi? It's just cola.
No. You can tell the difference.
You guys are crazy.
Pepsi's better.
Pepsi tastes like it's flat Coke.
We got to take a break, but when we get back, we're going to talk to Karen Fessler about the Iowa caucuses, and Skip Weber is back for another edition of the Weird News Challenge along with Tris Gazelle from 102.5. Going to be a great second hour. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to The Weekend Report on FM News Talk 97.1.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.